Great. Good morning. The graded homework is currently making its way through. I have the last homework here. I marked some problems as bonus. I think what I will do is I will consider the whole homework as bonus problems. So all problems should have a star there as far as the total number for calculating the grade, the total number of homework problems are concerned. I still encourage you to do the problems because they are relevant for the final. In the homework, which is just going back, the one remark I have is there was a problem to calculate the order of the product A times B. And there were two mistakes which came a couple of times. The one mistake is to somehow try to split it up, the order of A, of the product AB, to relate it to the order of A and the order of B. That does not work. Order is in no way multiplicative or like logarithm or anything. Basically, you can easily construct groups where if you give me three numbers, three numbers bigger than one, integers bigger than one, I can give you an example of a group and two elements where the orders of the elements are the first two numbers and the product has the third number. So that means there is no relation whatsoever for the order of a product based on the order of the factors, unless the factor has order one, and then it's the identity, and then the obvious thing happens. The other remark is that in general, in a group, AB to the n is not the same as A to the n, B to the n. So you can't just split this up. If the group is abelian, you can do. But if a group is not guaranteed to be abelian, you cannot assume this. So a proof which would split this up is plainly wrong. Basically, one way how one could prove it to show that the orders are the same is to use the definition. So you have, if the order of AB is K, then you get that AB, AB times AB, K copies of these is the identity. And now you take this equation and you multiply from the left with A inverse. A inverse from the left and multiply with A from the right. Again, because we can't guarantee, the group is not guaranteed to be abelian, we cannot just, we need to say from which side we multiply. If we do this, what happens? We get A inverse AB, 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 A. What happens here? The A inverse and the A cancel out. And on the right-hand side, we have A inverse times the identity times A. And that is A inverse times A. And that is the identity. Right. And what do we have we left here? Basically, just what happened with this process is that one A went away here and one A appeared here. So now we have K copies of BA. So this is actually BA to the K. Okay. So if the order of AB is K, we know that BA to the K is the identity. So we can conclude that the order of BA can be at most K, which was the order of AB. Right? Because the order is the smallest exponent where the power gives us the identity. Here we have an exponent which gives us the identity, so the order can't be bigger. Okay, by swapping the role of A and B, we also have that the order of AB, now I just swap the role of A and B, is smaller or equal than the order of BA. And these two together tell us
that the orders are the same.
Right. Yeah. That was what I wanted to say about the homework, which came back in the, with a new homework. The first problem is basically about the stuff which we did on the Friday before the break. The rest, 76 is about part of the material there, but part also newer. And the rest is basically newer material, which we will do now. Right. Are there any questions about homework or lecture or... Yeah? Yeah?
These numbers will show up twice in your permutation for the left circle and the right circle.
Yes.
And then when you want to use factorization...
They are two different permutations, right? You need to separate them with a comma. You can't just...
I tried that and it said that was not okay.
No, I mean, what you should be able to say, you should be able to say the group generated by 1, 2, 5, 7, 4, and then here a comma to separate that there is a new permutation. And now your second permutation, which is the rotation of the second circle, right?
Yeah.
And they are two permutations because you can rotate them separately. You don't are not forced to rotate them at the same time or immediately when you rotate one to rotate the other one the same amount.
So you define
you give, okay, and now the second cycle, and again, I don't remember what the numbers are, 2, 2, 6, 7, 8, or what, well, this is clearly wrong, but... Something like this, and you give these two cycles there.
So you define a group
of that, and then you do factoring. If you then do factorization, I mean, that's the same what we did, or you could give them name. You could first say, you could call this first left and this right, and then you say the group generated by left and right. And then if you do factorization, it should do this, yeah. Comma, and then the element which corresponds to your mix-up. Yes.
So, but with the mix-up, I try to do two permutations
of
the comma.
No. With a mix-up, you just get one single permutation, right? With a mix-up, you just forget about what the setup of the puzzle is, how where these circles are or so.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay? Okay.
Okay.
Good. Yeah?
I have a question on the last part related to that. You asked something
yes.
like, why isn't this
yes.
one related? And don't
yeah.
say
yes.
it fails.
Yes.
Are you wanting more than just a verbal description?
No.
Use those two
Well, the argument I'm looking for is basically, if you think about what we did on the Friday, last Friday, even and odd permutations. And if you look at your generators are both, I think there are five on each cycle, right?
For
so,
left and right.
Yeah, for left and right. They are both five cycles. So they are both even permutations. So any pro, so their inverses are also even permutations, and any product of them and their powers and inverses is also an even permutation. Okay? Other questions? No? Okay. So, what we did on that Friday, we finished basically with the concept of normal subgroups. So let me repeat this definition. If G is a group, I take a subgroup. Then N is normal, and that's why I call it N and not S or U or something like that. N is normal in G, and we write this triangle symbol, the same symbol as we used for ideal. N is normal in G, if and only if, for all elements N in N, for all elements G in G, I have that G inverse N G lies again in N. If this is the case, then the subgroup is called a normal subgroup. And if you can give me a single pair N G of an element in N and an element in G that this is not fulfilled, then the subgroup is not normal. Okay, first remark, this is something you might have seen already before, this kind of operation. You have a group element inverse from the one side and the group element from the other side. That's exactly the same thing what we did here in this trick, right? And that's a very typical thing which happens in group theory. Why does it happen? Or if you had linear algebra, you've seen this with matrices, right? If you do base change with matrices, or you look at similar matrices, then your G and N are matrices, and then you do exactly this kind of operation there. Why is this happening? It's simply happening because if you consider G and N as symmetry operations, let's suppose N would be a symmetry operation which says I rotate around this point here. And let's suppose G is the symmetry operation which translates one unit in this direction. Right? What is G inverse NG? Okay. I'm here. Now G inverse says I go do the translation in the inverse direction, right? Because it's G inverse. Now I do the symmetry operation. And what is the symmetry operation? It says this is rotation around this point here. So if I rotate around this point, now I rotate like this, right? Because the rotation axis does not go to me, through me. And now I do G inverse. What is G inverse? Now I do G. G says go one unit in this direction. If you allow myself to walk past the table, I end up here, right? Okay. So what happened? G inverse NG was from standing here like this, I end up here. I can do this in another way. I can achieve the same result in another way, namely by saying I translate my rotation axis. So if I take the rotation axis here and I apply the G, the translation, to that rotation axis, what would happen? Well, the rotation axis would move one unit here to the right. Okay? And now, if I rotate around this axis 90 degrees, what will happen? Well, I end up here like this. Right? So, what this... if you consider group elements as symmetry operations, what this kind of manipulation, which is called conjugation, really does is it says, don't do the symmetry operation N, do the translated symmetry operation, translated by G. And therefore, this is a very natural thing to happen. This is a very natural thing to do. And one example of this, what you have seen in, if you had linear algebra, is base change for a linear transformation. There, you just say you write down the same transformation just with respect to another basis. So there, instead of your translation is saying, okay, you look at it with respect to, it's not translation, it's looking at it with respect to another basis. But in general, so if you have, what this means is this gives you a symmetry which looks very similar in style, which will do in some way the same thing just in different coordinates or with a different basis point. And that's why this is an important operation which occurs very often. If you look, for example, at solution strategies for Rubik's Cube, if you look at this, you often have such things in there, that you have somewhere one operation inverse, then something, then this first operation forward again. Or you can throw the inverse instead here, right? It just matters how you define. The same thing happens. This is again the reason. If you want to do a rotation not of this slice, but of the front slice, how can you achieve a front slice rotation from a left slice rotation? By rotating the left slice to the front, doing the front slice rotation, and rotating it back. So that's why this kind of manipulation occurs often, and that's in some way why it is a natural thing to make a definition on it. Otherwise, if one looks at it the first time, one asks, why on earth are you doing this? This looks more complicated. But it really isn't as complicated as it looks. Okay. So if all these conjugates lie in there, the subgroup is called a normal subgroup. Let me do an example. And the example I want to do is the center of a group, which we had already in the midterm. So let's say G is a group. And we take the center of G, which was defined to consist of all elements X in G, so that for all G in G, I have that GX is equal to XG. Okay. Right. So, what I now want to show, we had seen in the midterm already that this is a subgroup. So now I want to show that it also is a normal subgroup. So what do I need to show, taking this definition? I need to take an arbitrary element in here. I need to take an arbitrary element in the group. Right? So let N be an element in the center of G, and let G be an arbitrary element in the group. Okay. And now what I need to show is that G inverse and G lies again in the center of the group. Right? If I can show this, I've shown the center is a normal subgroup, because that's exactly the definition of normal subgroup. Okay? Right. How can I show this? Now I need to use this defining property. Okay. So, I need to show that for any arbitrary group element, if I multiply it, that it commutes with any group element. Well, in this definition, the group element is called G, but I also have a G here, so I need to be slightly careful. Now I will call for the defining property, and I will instead write this with an element H, just to avoid a clash of letters. So for all H and G, I have that HX is equal to XH. Okay, right. So to show this, now I take an arbitrary element H in G. And what I want to show is that G inverse and G behaves the same way with, that this commutes with this element H, right? So I need to show that H times G inverse and G is the same as G inverse and G times H. Okay, so how can I show this? I can't just, the group is not necessarily commutative, so I can't just move this past. So how can I try to get, things by here? Well, I can certainly try. Well, let's start. So I have H G inverse N G. Okay. Well, somewhere I need to use the fact that N is not an arbitrary element, but that N is an element of the center, which commutes with everything, right? So I know that this is the same. Because N is in the center, I have that NG is the same as GN, because N is in the center of the group, right? So HG inverse NG is the same as H G inverse GN, and G inverse G is the identity. So this is H times the identity times N, which is equal to H times N. Okay, so I have, this looks already quite promising, and I've certainly simplified it. Okay, now I want to end up with this. If I don't have a good idea how to achieve this directly, it's sometimes worth to just start from the other end and to try, can we do the same trick? So we have here G inverse NG times H. Well, I can use exactly the same trick here. I can write NG instead as GN. So this is G inverse G N H, and that is just N times H, because G inverse G cancels out, right? So now what I just would need to show is that this is equal to this. Well, is it the case H is an arbitrary element in the group? I want to show that H N is N H. Well, that's again the defining property, right? I have N fulfills the property that it commutes with every element. So this is again, because N is in the center, that NH is the same as HN. Right? Because N commutes with everything. So what I have seen is, from this equation in the end, that G inverse NG commutes with any element H in the group. Well, this shows that G inverse NG is in the center, and that shows that the center is a normal subgroup. Right, before I start erasing things, are there questions? Yeah?
I just didn't catch the stuff. Why did you introduce H?
Okay. I introduced H because I had already G chosen here, right? Here I need to show for arbitrary elements. And these arbitrary elements here were called G. But I have G already used here for something, so I need to give it another name. So the if I just write G, I now would have two different Gs, and they would play two different roles. I could do it by drawing one in red and one in green or something like this. But I can't just mix them up. So that's why I said, okay, to avoid a clash of letters here, I rewrite this condition by just relabeling the letter G here as H. Okay? And that's something which is almost unavoidable unless you want to use different letters in any new condition. Since we are reusing letters, sometimes it might be, this might happen that we use the same letter for different things, and if two things come together, one of them needs to change the letters. I mean, it sometimes happens with sports teams that they play in certain jerseys, but they actually have two different jerseys because several teams might otherwise have look the same on the field. Other questions? Let me do another example. And that is something which is more concrete. Let's say we take G is the symmetric group S4, and we take for n, the subgroup generated by 1, 2, 3, 4, this double 2 cycle, and the double 2 cycle, 1, 3, 2, 4. And one can multiply out, and one finds this has in total 4 elements. Namely, it also has the identity, and it has the double 2 cycle, 1, 4, 2, 3. Okay. Now, in this case, this condition looks rather complicated, right? I would need to take any element of the group and any element of the normal subgroup. So I have 24 times 4 elements, pairs which I would need to test. And I certainly don't want to do this. So let me first just remark that it is sufficient to test, to do this normality test only with generators. To do the normality test only with generators. Why is this the case? Well, it is the case basically because it holds for generators, it will hold for arbitrary elements. And I can show you this quickly. Because if I look at G inverse, and now I look at a product N1 times N2G, I can write this also by inserting here an identity. I can certainly multiply an identity in. This does not change anything. But I write this identity as G inverse. So this is G inverse N1 G times G inverse N2G. So if N1 and N2 are generators, and I know that G inverse N1G and G inverse N2G both lie in, certainly their product lies in, right? So because of this trick, I'd need to test the elements of N only up to generators. And for inverses, it works basically the same way. What happens if I have, instead of G products, if I have G as a product, if I look if G is G1 times G2, what is G inverse? Then G inverse is G2 inverse G1 inverse. All right? So then I have that G inverse NG would be G2 inverse G1 inverse NG1 G2. And if I've tested it for generators, I know that this lies in N if it holds for generators. And then I have another element in N, and again it holds for generators. And then I do it in two steps that it lies in N. That's for products of length 2. It works for products of arbitrary length exactly the same way. It's just then rather messy to write down. So to test normality, it is sufficient to only test it for G and N running through generators of the groups. I don't need to run through all elements. And that will make our life much easier. Well, I need to give you generators of S4 here. S4, for example, is generated by the element swapping 1 and 2 and is generated by the element swapping 2 and 3 and is generated by the element swapping 3 and 4, as you will show, for example, in the first of the homework problems. So now, in this example, instead of 24 times 4, I only need to look at 3 times 2, which is 6 pairs. Okay. So now back to the example. So I need to calculate 1, 2 inverse times 1, 2, 3, 4 times 1, 2. What is this? 1, 2 inverse is the same as 1, 2, so I can really forget about the inverse. 1 goes to 2, goes to 1, goes to 2. 2 goes to 1, goes to 2, goes to 1. 3 stays fixed, goes to 4, stays fixed. 4 stays fixed, goes to 3, stays fixed. Okay. Or alternatively, when we take a product, we can could consider this here as a also as a multiplication of cycles on disjoint points. Cycles on disjoint points just commute, so I could have just pulled this 1, 2 in here, and then I have 1, 2 cubed, which is the same as 1, 2, because it's an element of order 2, and I've seen it directly. Okay, I do the same thing, 1, 2 inverse times the other generator, 1, 3, 2, 4, times 1, 2. Okay, here things are a little bit more interesting. What happens here? 1 goes to 2, goes to 4. 4 stays fixed, goes to 2, goes to 1. Okay, so I can close the parenthesis. What happens with 2? 2 goes to 1, goes to 3, stays fixed. 3 stays fixed, goes to 1, goes to 2. So that's the product here. And now, I mean, I could test on generators, just I now would need to test that it's an element of this normals, of this subgroup here. I didn't write out the four elements, but I mentioned, apart from the identity, this is the third element of the subgroup, or the fourth element of the subgroup. So this is in N. Okay, now the same thing with 2, 3. 2, 3 inverse times 1, 2, 3, 4 times 2, 3. And 2, 3 inverse times 1, 3, 2, 4. 2, 3, what do I get there? 1 stays fixed, goes to 2, goes to 3. 3 goes to 2, goes to 1, stays fixed. 2 goes to 3, goes to 4, stays fixed. And similarly, 4 goes to 2. And here, which again lies in N, it's actually one of the generators. Similarly here, 1 stays fixed, goes to 3, goes to 2. And this similarly becomes 1, 2, 3, 4. Basically, if I do this operate, I can see this from this line here. If I do the same thing again, here I multiply once more with 2, 3 from the left and with 2, 3 from the right. The 2, 3's both cancel each other out. So that's why these are the same. And finally, 3, 4 times 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4. Here the same argument as there with the disjoint cycles gives me this is 1, 2, 3, 4, which lies in N, and finally 3, 4 inverse times 1, 3, 2, 4, 3, 4 is equal to 1 stays fixed, goes to 3, goes to 4, 4 goes to 3, goes to 1, stays fixed, 2 stays fixed, goes to 4, goes to 3, 3 goes to 4, goes to 2, stays fixed. So indeed, it's this element, and this is again an N. And the first one obviously also is an N. So I have checked that this subgroup of order 4 is again a normal subgroup. Okay. So we can test whether a subgroup is normal. We have not seen a general method how to find normal subgroups. The only normal subgroups which we clearly know about is the full group and the trivial subgroup. They are always normal. That's the same as with ideals. Otherwise, in general, it's harder to find normal subgroups of a group, or to find whether a group has normal subgroups. Okay. So that's normal subgroups. They will play the same role as ideals. So we will get that we can form factor groups corresponding to factor rings in exactly the same way, and they will be kernels of homomorphisms. Okay. For actually looking at factor groups, we know but what were factor rings, they consisted of cosets. So now we need to look at cosets in groups. And in some way it's exactly the same idea as cosets in rings. The only difference here is, well, there are is that we generally write the group multiplicatively and not additively. So we will have a product, respectively, an inverse there, where we have plus or minus, where we had plus or minus with the cosets in a ring. The other difference, and this is something we will see in a little while, is that in rings, cosets looked a little bit ad hoc. Yes, we could define this equivalence relation. We got these sets and they had some property. But there was no natural way. What would a coset mean? What we will see is that in groups, cosets actually are a very natural thing. And in some ways, I gave you this example in the vector space where the cosets would correspond to, of a line would correspond to lines which do not go through the origin, but are parallel to it. And similarly, we will see that cosets consist of elements which in some way act in a similar way. But we'll see this a little bit later. So now, cosets. So let's start with a definition. Let's suppose that H is a subgroup of a group G. For an element little g in G, we consider the set, which I write as HG, which is the set of all products H times G. H lies in H, is called a right coset of H. Okay. So, first remark, this is exact, well, the, or I think with ideals we defined it as equivalence classes under an equivalence relation. But then we had a lemma which said, this is what a coset of an ideal or what of a subring is. It consists, and the only difference is here we have products. In the ring case we had pluses. But that's just because now the single operation we write as multiplication. We could have written it as plus and then it would look exactly the same as the definition of a coset in an ideal. In a ring. Okay. Second remark. Here I say right coset. And that is new. We didn't have this with ideals. And that's because groups are not necessarily commutative. So I could similarly define, a left coset, which would be GH, which would be the set of all products GH, where H lies in H. And they are different objects, left cosets and right cosets. Indeed, they are in general different. Let me just note this. The subgroup H is normal in G if and only if HG is the same as GH for all G in G. I don't want, the proof is not very hard, but we don't really need it later on. So I don't want to go into more detail there. But if the subgroup is not normal, right coset and left cosets really are different things. It happens because the operation in the group is not necessarily commutative. What I will do now is basically just look at the right cosets. Some other books just look at left cosets. It doesn't really matter which way around you do it. It's advisable not to mix them up forwards, backwards. But that's the only reason why this word right occurs in here. And if you just forget about the word right and you just look at this, you're perfectly fine with everything. So these are cosets. Exactly the same definition. And again, one can show they are equivalence classes under an equivalence relation. So let's first look at the when are cosets equal. So HG, if HG is the same as H little h, I claim this is the case if and only if G H inverse lies in H. And in ideals, we had the corresponding thing. We had the condition that X minus Y lie, they had to lie in the ideal for which we took cosets. And that's exactly the same thing here. Just X minus Y multiplicatively becomes X times Y inverse. Okay, why is this the case? So let's give a proof for this. If HG, so if HG is equal to HH, this means that I can write, well, clearly G lies in here, right? Because I can write G as the identity times G, which is G. So G lies in the coset HG. If it this coset is the same to the coset HH, I can write G is equal to X times little h for X in this subgroup H. And then I can multiply with H inverse. So I get that G times H inverse is equal to X. And X, I said, did lie in this subgroup. So I get, if the cosets are equal, I have this condition, vice versa. If GH inverse lies in the subgroup, then I have basically the same thing in reverse. I can write G as X times, or I can write G as GH inverse, which did lie in the subgroup times H. And therefore, the set of products, the products X G for X in H are the same as the products X H where X runs through this subgroup. So, and this is basically exactly the same proof as we had for cosets in rings, when two cosets are the same. Just now the condition is multiplicatively written. So that's when two cosets are the same. And we can actually, one can show, I don't want to do this now, but one can show, again, basically by the same amount of work as we did with cosets in rings, for a subgroup H of G, the relation that G is related to H by definition, if and only if G times H inverse lies in H, this is an equivalence relation. relation, the cosets are the equivalence classes. Okay, so that's the cosets in groups, really the same definition, the same property for equality as with cosets in rings. Let me do an example, probably, before starting something new. Let's take an example. Let's take as group the integers modulo 6 with addition as operation. Let's take a subgroup, the subgroup generated by the number 3, which consists of the elements 0 and 3, right? Because it consists of 0, 3, 3 plus 3, which is 0, 3 plus 3 plus 3, which is 3, and so forth. Then what are the cosets? And in some way, this is basically the same example. I could have given you this example with rings, or I might even have given it to you with rings. It's exactly the same situation. I have h times the identity element. So this is 0. Now my operation is plus 0 plus 0 and 3 plus 0. I have h and I have as a representative, let's say, the number 1. There I would get 0 plus 1, which is 1, and 3 plus 1, which is 4. And I get the coset. Which number haven't I used yet? The number 2 does not yet occur, so I can take the representative 2. And what do I get here? I get 0 plus 2, which is 2, and 3 plus 2, which is 5. And as before, or as one sees already from the fact that they are equivalence classes, the cosets form a partition of the whole group. Every group element occurs exactly in one coset. Okay. And here I just had to write plus because my operation on the elements in the end was addition. Let's also do an example with permutation, say. Let's say G is the symmetric group S3 on three letters, and my subgroup H is the subgroup generated by the permutation 1, 2, which consists of the identity and this permutation. This is a cyclic subgroup generated by a single element. Now, what are the cosets? One coset, I can always take the subgroup itself as a coset with identity representative, right? So I can take H, which is the same as H times the identity permutation. What is this? Well, it just consists of the identity permutation and the permutation 1, 2. Okay. Are these all the cosets? No, because I've just listed down 2 elements out of 6. So there are elements missing. How can I find other cosets? By just looking at elements which I haven't yet used. So, for example, I could take the permutation swapping the points 2 and 3. And what do I get there? I get the identity times 2, 3, which is 2, 3. And I get 1, 2 times 2, 3. And if I multiply this out, this is 1 goes to 3. 3 is stays fixed, goes to 2, 2 goes to 1, stays fixed, so this is 1, 3, 2. So this coset consists of these 2 elements, and I could have written this coset differently. I could have written it as H with representative 1, 3, 2. It doesn't really matter which representative I pick. I could pick either of the elements as representative. Now I have four elements. There are still some missing. For example, the element swapping 1 and 3. So I could take H and I'm swapping 1 and 3. What do I get there? I get the identity times 1, 3, which is just 1, 3. And I get 1, 2 times 1, 3. What is this? 1 goes to 2, stays fixed. 2 goes to 1, goes to 3. 3 stays fixed, goes to 1. So this is a 3 cycle, 1, 2, 3. And again, I could have written this coset as H times 1, 2, 3. And now I have all 6 elements accounted for. So these are the 3 cosets of this subgroup. Okay, right. I think now I'm basically out of time, unless there is a question about these examples. No? Then thank you very much, and I see you on Wednesday.